Hello and welcome everyone back to another episode of the Publisher Lab. I'm Tyler Bishop and joined Zoom alongside me. I don't know. I don't think that's something we're going to get going, but nevertheless, Shelby Kang, welcome back.
Hi, great to be back. Another week in digital publishing.
And it's a really exciting time, I think, for digital publishing for a lot of different reasons. But I think that everyone is getting more and more accustomed to the digital space between us, if that makes sense. And I think we're all getting better at different forms of remote video exchanges and communication. And so this podcast is no different. So you and I have been doing this podcast now for almost 6-7 months remotely. And I think we're getting better at it.
I hope so. Now that especially we've started doing videos, kind of just gives everybody another way to consume. So if you ever want to know what Tyler and I look like, or just want to watch us talk for some reason, or
want to see how I've decorated my home office, you're welcome to do so.
Yeah, but we've got a lot going on this week. So the first topic I wanted to start with was from Search Engine Journal, and it's about how Google has been accused of anti-competitive practices.
Oh no, not Google.
Oh no, and this is according to a new government report. So the House Antitrust Subcommittee released a 450-page report that accused Google of creating its market dominance through anti-competitive behavior. So it asserts that Google maintains the monopoly through browser and mobile device default settings that gives Google preference over its competitors. It basically forces phone manufacturers to make Google apps as the default, as well as using acquisitions as a way to achieve market dominance. So among the tactics that Google was accused of using, some of them were unfairly using third-party content to benefit its own inferior vertical offerings, and that's in quotes, inferior vertical offerings, imposing penalties on competing verticals to benefit Google's verticals, stuffing the search results with ads to push down organic results, making it difficult for users to distinguish ads from organic results, and pushing down organic search results by using its own content. So the report also proposed some solutions for restoring the competition and for preventing digital companies from manufacturing their own market dominance. And so some of those included creating a structural separation and prohibitions of certain dominant platforms from operating in adjacent lines of business, non-discrimination requirements prohibiting dominant platforms from engaging in self-preferencing, and creating a safe harbor for news publishers in order to safeguard a free and diverse press. I know there was talk maybe last month about actual, I guess, what would you call it?
Regulatory action, maybe?
Yeah, so a report is a little bit, I guess, not as action-oriented as what we may have been expecting. But it is kind of some news from that ongoing case.
Yeah, and so this is something we've sort of been expecting for a little while. I guess one of the things that stood out to me in sort of just how this was released and some of the information that we keep hearing coming out of the subcommittee is that there's not alignment within the committee itself. So even though you have chairs on the committee that seem to support largely, you know, similar types of actions or things within the report, there's others that are saying, well, maybe these things are heavy-handed. And I even saw that one member of the committee had said, actions won't need to be significant to make real change. And my first thought there was, no, like that's exactly what, you know, I think there was a time whenever I really wondered, like, will there be, you know, the chance that some significant action comes of this? Because the State Department did a really good job of basically investigating the, I guess the underlying architecture of Google's dominance and things like really advertising. And I think that, you know, the focus on things like search results, push, you know, ads pushing down organic results. I actually think that those are a little bit of a distraction, because those are negative user experiences to a product. And not necessarily something that I think you want a government to regulate, like how a company orientates the product, unless it's like actively deceiving the population or something like that. And I'm sure there's people that want to argue with me about that. But realistically, I think it detracts from the fact that Google owns, largely owns two major verticals within the same space, and that is advertising. They both own the platform in which advertisers use to buy and sell, or basically buy advertising. And then they also basically own the mechanism in which publishers use to sell their ad space. So they own both sides of a marketplace, and they govern the principles and the underlying auctions and commerce trade that regulates the entire thing. So, you know, it's basically like they're everything, you know, buyer, seller, marketplace, regulator, they're all those things. And that is why, you know, they deserve this kind of scrutiny for this type of thing. And, you know, Amazon and Apple are getting similar treatment, Facebook too, to an extent. And they all are being questioned about the same thing, which is, can you use market dominance in one area, to create dominance in another? Because that's the definition of antitrust. And in Google's case, there are competitors. You can buy ads without Google. You can even buy display ads without Google. And as a publisher, you can also sell them. But it's not the same. There's no way that you can recreate, both as an advertiser and a publisher, the value, even remotely close than what you can get with Google alone. You can probably find some one-off examples, but it is very difficult and it's not scaled. And so, I do think that the investigation was good, but I don't see anything on the docket right now that resembles anything close to a breakup or anything that would cause any major shifts in the way that things operate today.
Yeah, it's disappointing, but not surprising, I would say.
No, it's not surprising. And I do want to share that I thought that this was like a waste of time. And then as it got closer and closer, I started to think, wow, this might shake things up a little bit if they really decide to do something with the results of this investigation. But my concern is that it doesn't seem like there's really an appetite for it. At least not, there's nobody that seems to be leading that charge.
All right. So the next topic we have on deck is from MediaPost. And it's titled, "Was Quartz's Subscription Strategy a Mistake?" So the diverging fortunes of new startups Quartz and Axios offers some insights about monetization strategies for publishers. So while Axios is thriving and has plans to expand, Quartz is said to be on the auction block after cutting jobs this year. So the coronavirus pandemic and its economic fallout have hurt publishers, but the pain appears to be unevenly distributed. So Axios is on course to boost revenue by 30% to $58 million and make profit this year. So right now they're focusing on finding more sponsors for their free newsletters, and this is according to the Wall Street Journal. In contrast, Quartz saw a major drop in revenue after they revamped the business model to lessen their dependence on advertising, and this is according to public findings. So to diversify revenue, Quartz started charging a subscription fee. So currently it's $100 a year or $15 a month. And Quartz is estimated to see $1.9 million in subscription revenue this year. And they ended the first half of the year with about 21,000 subscribers. So in a public report to investors, the company said that the pandemic is actually helping them to increase subscriptions to Quartz, likely as more people are working from home and spending more time reading the news. However, these subscription gains weren't enough to overcome a steep drop in ad revenue that hurt overall reports. So Quartz total revenue plunged 57% to just $5 million in the first half of the year, compared to a year earlier. So obviously it's easy to say that, you know, the publisher made a mistake in charging subscriptions, especially given the difficulties of weaning an audience off of free content. That being said, you know, people are willing to pay for value-added news and information. It's just kind of a matter of offering exclusive content that can't be found anywhere and kind of boosting the value proposition for those paying readers. But yeah, I thought this was an interesting one, kind of just a cautionary tale, especially now that, you know, more than ever, there's more ways to monetize your content, I think, than ever before.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, it's a lesson that didn't need to be learned the way that they learned it, because it was very easy to kind of predict. And I think that there ends up being a lot of industry hype and grandstanding. And I think what happens a lot, and especially with the, you know, large media conglomerates and media businesses that are big and in some cases probably bureaucratic, is these ideas don't get disconnected from the people. And what I mean by that is that if your strategy as a executive, let's say, is to ensure that basically you don't derive the majority of your revenue from advertising or something like that, you look around and you say, okay, what can work? And the trend is subscriptions or something like that. So you roll out what sounds like a really great idea, and you just go for it, regardless of whether or not the data is there to support it, or even if at first try it doesn't appear to be working. There's no testing, there's no lean ramp up or anything like that. And so, yeah, I think in general that this is a really great example of what not to do. So yeah, the way you change a revenue model in publishing is not to pick a revenue model and go. It's really to figure out what your audience will support. And I think when you find out subscriptions don't work, you realize they're not your audience. Meaning like they're not Quartz readers. They are news readers and they happen to like Quartz, but not enough to pay for it because there's lots of places to get news. And I think one of the trends that we've seen inside of the pandemic is that there are people that are willing to pay to subscribe to specific news, opinions, and articles, but it's really people that like specific creators. So you've seen this trend where reporters or journalists have basically gone independent or semi-independent with newsletters or Patreon or different things like that. And that's the result of basically people saying, I want to support this person in the same way that somebody supports a podcast or, you know, something else. But there's, you know, that's a limited thing as well. And then you get into almost like the entertainment business where you're basically trying to build personalities. And that's the way we watch television news and information go a long time ago as well. And so news as a commodity is probably not going to be supported with subscriptions. It's just the way of it. So there are opportunities to do these things. And I think that there's a creative way you can use data to start like pushing more mixed revenue models, depending on the type of person, because there are probably people that are willing to be subscribers under certain conditions. But, you know, I think if you, again, the way to do this is not to pick a revenue model and decide you're going to make it work. It's to figure out what you can support, to run tests, and then to let data guide you. But I liked Quartz a lot. Not enough to subscribe, but I liked it.
Yeah, $15 for news a month. I mean, you could sign up to so many other, I guess, news publications that are around that price that are, I don't know, just a bit different.
Well, and then you look at the fact that it's like the pivot to subscription is quickly followed by the pivot to discounts, where I can't tell you how many news subscription services I've gotten ads for recently where it's like, you don't even have to pay. You don't even have to give us a credit card. Just sign up now and you get like a year free, 6 months free, a month free, because they really just want to be able to report that they're going to get that annual recurring revenue to a board or something like that. And yeah, I promise you that's not going to be a happy story here come 6 months from now either.
Kind of continuing on the line of, you know, revenue diversification, the last topic I have is from DigiDay. And it's titled, Amazon On-Site Associates has gotten bumpy for some participating publishers. So following a number of tests that participants say Amazon has not adequately explained, revenue for many participants of Amazon's affiliate program has dramatically fallen, and in some cases by more than 90%, according to sources at 9 different publishers that participate in the program. So a source at one of the publications, which has seen their on-site associates' revenue drop by more than 70% this year, may abandon the plan unless they experience a major surge in revenue in the fourth quarter. Not every publisher has seen such dramatic slides in revenue. Two sources contacted for the story said they were earning more now than they did from the start. Another one said that they saw their revenue drop significantly after expanding the kinds of content it produced, but it's just simply scaled that back. So publishers' level of frustration seemed to mirror how much time and energy that they've invested on this. While many got started with the program simply by reformatting or modifying existing commerce content, others began developing content specifically for on-site associates. So much like short-form videos publishers produced and failed to monetize on Facebook, on-site associate participants who built content specifically for the program have been frustrated to discover that content made for that platform didn't make money and that they cannot monetize it using other content programs and arrangements. So I know it's kind of a rough episode for different types of revenue streams, but that's just what's going on this week.
Yeah, I think, you know, a lot of the independent publishers that are listening to this can, you know, will say finally they're being valid, you know, vindicated and also validated for a lot of the criticism that they were giving to Amazon and the Amazon Associates or affiliate program earlier this year when they cut commissions for a lot of the major categories that people were like seeing surges in sales for. And yeah, I mean, there's this trend of creating content specifically to sell people Amazon stuff, basically. And, you know, you can look at that as a business practice and say, look, that's a risky business practice to start with, right? It's like being a retailer that specializes in, I'm trying to think, basically just selling another company's product exclusively. And knowing that, you know, if that company decides they're not going to work with you or they're going to cut their wholesale distribution costs or something like that and you have no alternative, you know, there you have it. It's a huge business risk. And I think this is where publishing is really far behind a lot of other industries, and they don't have to be. Obviously, for a lot of different reasons, I'm a big proponent of machine learning. But if you think about, let's think about like the internet in general and how it's delivered. Another area of business that Amazon is very familiar with, Amazon Web Services. A huge portion of the internet's delivered via Amazon Web Services. They have Arlington, Virginia, maybe? Either way, they have a giant server facility in Virginia. And if something happens, there's an earthquake or whatever, it goes down. Immediately upon going down, all the traffic and all the cloud there is redirected and redistributed across other data centers across the world. And I think one of the things that publishers have been really hard to pivot into is if you have a revenue model or you have a particular type of content that you're monetizing one way and that revenue stream starts getting cut off, not being able to recognize that, not being able to just, I mean, not even just in real time, but it's like, I feel like a lot of times publishers are like, oh, I noticed revenue is down in June. And then in July, it's like, why is our revenue so far down? And then by August, they're going, dang it, Amazon has screwed us over. And meanwhile, they've lost 3 months of revenue with, you know, few adjustments, or the adjustments they did make were really just to try to figure out how they squeeze more Amazon bucks out of the content. And I think that that's a concern. And I also think that not being able to understand your existing content and how it's valuable, how it's changing, how it's shifting, how it's trending up or down over time. I think so many publishers are flying blind on that. And I think there's a lot that think that they're not, but unless you know what your earnings per 1,000 visitors are for every single top landing page, how it's diversified across different traffic sources, and if it's largely search, which queries are the ones that are driving revenue and which queries drive the most revenue per visitor and why. You'll always struggle with this and you're going to be behind. And I think that that's where both machines can help this industry a lot, and I think will inevitably, and then also just where understanding and having this data will make a tremendously big difference.
Well, that's actually all the topics that I've got going on this week. Is there anything else that you want to throw in?
Kind of. I'll throw one thing in, and it's only because I'm seeing it grow in popularity. And I mentioned it on Twitter. If you listen to this podcast and you don't follow me on Twitter, you listen to this podcast, I've already got you to some degree. So you might as well follow me on Twitter. It's at Tyler Bishop. And I talked about this earlier this week, but the rise in newsletter subscriptions that we were talking a little bit about earlier, where you're seeing independent journalists start to be able to go independent with newsletter subscriptions and stuff like that. You're seeing platforms like Substack be touted as like this new exciting thing, but realistically it's a CMS, the same as, you know, a WordPress site or Medium or something like that. All you're doing is your CMS is a newsletter and a newsletter house where you're just republishing it. You could easily do that with just about any CMS system. I would caution publishers that are thinking that somehow newsletters, which AKA, by the way, newsletters are emails, that emails are somehow this breakthrough new technology or breakthrough new channel for publishing. I caution that because I think every publisher, and I've talked about this before, should be using email as a channel with their audience to some degree. I mean, I think there's publishers that can build an entire, their entire business around it. And I think there's publishers where it's, 1 to 5% of their total traffic maybe, but either way, it's a good direct channel that you shouldn't ignore and should be trying to build. But I think that there's a lot of attention and hype and maybe even a bubble around this idea of subscription newsletters. So I would just caution that a little bit as being a direction, just because we were talking earlier on about, picking, subscriptions or whatever it is a go-to model. And I see newsletters getting a lot of attention that way. And it concerns me because I love the idea, but I'm also sort of like, what am I missing? We're sending emails. We've been sending emails for a while, right?
It's definitely a saturated market, like how podcasts were all the rave, I don't know, maybe 1 or 2 years ago. And everyone's like, let's start a podcast. We can definitely make money.
And then how many people do you know now that have a podcast?
Well, I mean, it's silly to say because Tyler, we have a podcast.
I know. And guess what? I have like 3.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Well, then I guess that kind of sums up our episode for this week. If everyone has some time to leave us a review, those are always greatly appreciated.
They are. They are greatly appreciated. And we want to thank everybody for watching, perhaps, or if not watching, just listening on all the different platforms. We appreciate it. And any chance you have to leave us a review, we cherish those. Those things help us continue to grow. And that's it. From Shelby Kang and myself, this is the Publisher Lab.